scripture for tonight. Hillary D.
Thank you. My name is Hillary Draper, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. Good evening. That tells you who I am and what I am. And when the two of us got up this morning, the who said to the what, we ain't going to take a drink today. And that's the way it's been all day long. But it didn't used to be that way. It used to be that the who got up and would say to the what, we ain't going to take a drink today. And the what would say, who said so? And the who would say, I said so. And the what would say, just you wait and see. And the what would get drunk and the who would have the hangover. It's not original. Y'all got good microphones. When I was drinking, I used to suffer from the shakes and the hot flashes. I don't shake anymore. But I do have the hot flashes. And the Serenity Prayer says, if you can do something about it, do something. And I can. I can fan. And if this fan bothers you, that's your problem. It's not mine. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to come. And I certainly am just delighted to be here. Everything's been lovely. There was a nice basket in my room. And the only place I get to wear flowers is in AA. You know, I'm a celibate landlord, and we don't ordinarily wear flowers. But if they give them to me in AA, I'll sure wear them. I also want to thank my driver and my bodyguard who's sitting back there. If you'll stand and take a bow, I'd appreciate it. And I'll have you know they paid the price of admission. They're none of these $5 cheapies. But we've had a great time. What I'm supposed to do is tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And that's not supposed to be an ego trip. It's supposed to be a revealing thing that maybe somebody's sitting out there trying to figure out whether or not he still is a little bit pregnant, can hear something that I might say and catch his breath and say, oh my goodness, if this program would work for that fat priest, it might wait for me. But before I do that, I crave your indulgence to read you two paragraphs out of the big book. In chapter 11, it says, for most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends. And a feeling that life is good. Are you sure I'm in the right book? The next sentence clears it up. But not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. As we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily we did. Then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. And what I hope to do tonight in the time allotted to me is to show you how my terror has turned into joy and acceptance and faith. And my bewilderment has turned into certainty and poise. And my frustration has been turned into serenity and fulfillment. And how my despair has been turned into hope. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a miracle. I was born at a very early age in a good Christian home. I've heard so many alcoholics say that, and I'm not sure it's any way to raise children anymore. But I was. And it was a Catholic household in Mobile, Alabama, and we did not think it was morally wrong to drink in moderation. Actually, it was part of, and still is, I have to be careful, part of my religion. We drank for baptisms, christenings. We drank for confirmation. We drank for first communions. In fact, the Mass, they actually used wine. They don't use grape juice. We drank for weddings. We drank for funerals. We drank for ordinations. The only thing we didn't drink for was confession. And some of us had to take a few drinks to steady our nerves for that. You know, if it could be said of anybody that he should have had an education how to drink like a gentleman, it should have been me, because it was always in our home. Oh, yes, I saw drunkenness, and we Catholics think that drunkenness is seriously morally wrong, just like the Baptists and some of the Methodists do. And I saw drunkenness in my family. We had one Harry, uncle, call him Harry. I had six aunts and one adopted, and they had their own population explosion. And whenever that tribe got together for weddings and funerals, and Uncle Harry would have to be the leader of the pack, he was always taking one more drink to steady his nerves. The only thing is he'd get so steady, he'd have to carry him home. And I can remember my mother would say to us kids the next morning, "You saw Uncle Harry last night. If you find that drinking does that to you, you don't drink." But you saw the rest of your uncles and aunts, perfect ladies and gentlemen. I didn't know what alcoholism was. I didn't know until I got to the big book and to this glorious program that it was a physical compulsion tied up with a mental obsession to drink. I didn't know that an alcoholic was a person of whatever shape, size, age, didn't make any difference, who after he took the first drink of alcohol, you could no longer foretell with any accuracy what was going to happen to him. I didn't know that. I didn't know that the simple definition that I have myself of an alcoholic, namely a person of whatever size, shape, creed, who drinks and gets in trouble because he drinks. Who drinks and gets in trouble because she drinks. Who drinks and drinks. You can get into trouble besides for things besides drinking. But if I got into as much trouble from eating watermelon as I did from drinking the last 5 years of my drinking, I'd have quit eating watermelon a long time ago. You see, that's the insidiousness of this disease. I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I was a wanted child. My mother and father knew I was coming. They welcomed me into this world. I was covered with tender, loving care. The God of my understanding was given to me by tender, loving people. He was my father. He wasn't a policeman. You know, what in the hell am I doing an alcoholic? I mean, with my splendid aristocratic background, degenerate southern aristocracy, if the truth is known, my splendid education, I got degrees, I went to Harvard, boy, I'm telling you, and Catholic University. Lord have mercy, in the University of Amen. I'm an ordained priest. I'm an eminent divine, at least of the second water. What in the hell am I doing an alcoholic? And you know, I asked them at Coleman, in my group, the noble group at Coleman, in a closed meeting, after I'd been in some time, I said, I want to know something. Why am I an alcoholic? Why am I an alcoholic? And there was this great silence that comes over the group when you know, everybody knows the answer. And they're waiting to see who's going to zap the fool. And finally, Juby says, oh, hell, Father Hillary, it don't make no difference how the jackass got into the ditch. Just get him out. And that's wisdom. That is real wisdom. I can't begin to tell you. I was quoting Freud this morning. And Freud, you know, says, with most of the psychologists that we still follow today, straighten out the acting. Now, straight out the thinking, and the acting will follow. Straight out the thinking, the acting will follow. And Dr. Bob and Bill turned it around, said, don't worry about the thinking. Straighten out the acting, and the thinking can follow. Bring the body, we say. Go to the meetings. And a new person says, what good will it do me to go to the meetings if I don't want to go to the meetings? What good will I get? I said, don't know, but go to the meetings. Bring the body. Act as if. Fake it till you make it. All those stupid things we talk about. Our whole program flies in the very face of psychology. And yet the amazing thing is that it works. We are the most successful people on the face of the earth for recovering from the dread disease of alcoholism. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. My old sponsor, Tom Pettis, who's gone to heaven, used to say if he had one word to change in the big book, it would be that. And he would have put in there, never have we seen it fail. Rarely have we seen it fail. What was I like? A towering ego, king baby syndrome, doubled and in spades. Lord have mercy. A mess, that's all I've got to say. My father was dead when I was 4 years old. I resented God for that. And lots of people lose a parent early in life. They don't make a federal case out of it. I think people help me make a federal case. Poor child, he hadn't got any daddy. You know, I said, yeah, poor child, haven't got any daddy. I milked it for all it was worth. I can remember that. And I can remember, I really did. I had a marvelous grandfather who was the male image in my life. Thank God for that. A splendid mother. But it wasn't the same. And I did not adjust. I was not a well-adjusted child at all. I was a mess. That's all there was to that. I was the kind of kid, I was not well-coordinated. I'm still not well-coordinated. I was the kind of kid that when they chose up sides to play any ball game, you were always the last one to be chosen. You take him and we'll take him. You know, that kind. I didn't adjust well to my peer group. I was smart in school, but that, academically smart, but I didn't, that's not what I really wanted. When I was 15 years old, I say my mother sold me up the river from Mobile, Alabama to the tender mercies of the Benedictines at Coleman, and I never got away. And I didn't adjust well when I went to Coleman. I was another mess. I'm telling you, it was awful. I was homesick and I was, oh. The only thing I think that saved me was that I got in with some of the families of my classmates in Coleman. And all the Coleman housewives with that name in those far-off halcyon days knew how to make that German-type grape juice. Only they did it with Coleman County strawberries. And if y'all never tasted Coleman County strawberry wine before you got an AA, it's just too late. You'll have to wait to get to heaven. I'm serious. The most glorious color of red I've ever seen in a wine. An aroma, you could smell it in the block when you took the cork out of the bottle. And a kick like the proverbial Missouri mule. And you were in no trouble. You're in somebody's home, small glass homemade wine, a piece of cake, lovely. I loved everything about St. Bernard and Coleman so much, I asked if I could join, be a monk. They said I could try. And in 1941, 19 years old, I entered the monastery as a rookie. And they began to tell me the 33rd degree secrets. And one of the biggest of these was that the monks were not about to be outdone by the housewives of Kalman. And they too know how to squeeze that grape and make that German-type grape juice. And they made a little homebrew on the side. You talk about a revelation to the Gentiles. I remember that just as well when my eyeballs popped open, you know. You must not think that there's 50 drunk monks at Coleman. There's not. There's me. The rest of them are pretty normal. And for your information, we no longer manufacture. We did not drink every day in those days. On a big feast day for an hour after Vespers, you come together, if you know the German word, Gemütlichkeit, with ham sandwiches and cheese and cigars, the homemade wine and homebrew, pink lemonade for the panty waist. But right there, looking back, I can see what I was like. It always meant more to me than it meant to other people. I was always figuring out, when is the next time this going to happen? And don't be late. Be there early. Be the first one there and the last one to leave. It's carried on well in AA, you know, get the first one there, be the last one to leave. That was one of my characteristics. I have to say that I was one of the maybe lucky or unlucky people who liked everything about drinking. The big book says the reason we drink is because we like the effects of drinking. Well, not only like the effects, I like the taste. I like the smell. I like the looks of it. I like the feel of it. Yeah. Then I'm sorry about that. I'm the kind that used to take a great big mouthful and swallow it real slow, and then suck your teeth. God knows, you know. And from that time, I set my pattern. My pattern for drinking was this. I always drank as much as I could, as often as I could, as long as I could, whenever I could. The only two things that ever made me stop drinking from the time I was 19 years old, and I didn't care what you had, was either I was too sick to drink anymore, or there was nothing left to drink. And those are not normal drinking patterns, but that's the way it was with me. At Christmas in 1941, 19 years old, I suffered my first blackout. Before I knew what a blackout was, I went into that unconscious state, temporary amnesia, continued to function, quote, normally, quote, but don't remember anything about it. That phenomenon that all alcoholics experience. You know, you Al-Anon, you say to your alcoholic, where were you last night? He says, I don't remember. And you say, stop lying. He may well not be lying. He may not have the foggiest clue of where he was last night. Who were you with last night? I don't remember. Lying again. He may not. He may not. We have the most astounding stories told as gospel truth by alcoholics. One of them I'll never forget. In the Army, in the Air Force, got in an airplane, checked it out in Atlanta, flew to San Francisco, got out, had a few drinks, and came on back. And if he hadn't signed the flight plan, he wouldn't even know he'd left Atlanta. You know, it's scary. It's real scary. And there I am suffering a blackout at 19 years old in a monastery. You don't join the monasteries to become drunks. You join monasteries as a special kind of Christian witness. And here I am joining a monastery at 19, and I'm a lush. Because, you see, if you've experienced what I just described, the blackout, it's almost a Satan sign that you got it. That you're a little bit pregnant. And when I say that, I say it deliberately, because there is no such thing as being a little bit pregnant. You either are or you aren't, one of the two. There's no such thing as being a little bit alcoholic. And if you have experienced what I've described, and you're still sitting over in Al-Anon, maybe you ought to move your letter. We get a lot of fine members that way. But there I am, 19 years old. You know, if anybody had said to me, Hillary, what you've just described says you've got this physical compulsion coupled with this mental obsession to drink, and you're never going to get better. You're never going to get better. Maybe I could have. The big book says that most of us, if we could find a compelling enough reason, we might have been able early on to control the situation. I don't know, but nobody says anything to me about it. You know why, don't you? Because I don't say anything to them. You don't think I was going to go describe that phenomenon? And why don't I describe it? I think that way, way back in the back of my mind, I knew that that had been caused by alcohol. But I told you, at that time, I loved everything there was about alcohol. I wasn't about to admit that anything I loved that much could have to do anything bad to me. But again, I had to reach an intelligent decision. What caused that phenomenon? And after I considered it with Aristotelian Thomistic principles of philosophy and psychology, I came to the conclusion that it was the cheese. Isn't that stupid? But you see, alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. Alcoholics are cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I conned myself. We're con people. We can con the buds out of the trees. And the ones we con the worst are ourselves. I said for years, and honestly believed it, I can quit drinking any time I want to. And people were saying to me, well, why in the hell don't you want to? You sure ought to. Yeah. And when the day came, because this is a progressive disease, and it means it gets worse, not better. If we've crossed that invisible line between controlled and uncontrolled drinking, then that disease is going to progress to one of three ends. Either we end up dead drunk, in the literal meaning of those two words. We end up in custodial care. Which means in Alabama, you go to Tuscaloosa, and that's not to the university. I don't know where they send you in Georgia. Third, I quit. And the horrible thing for the alcoholic is when he gets to that point that he would rather be sober than drunk, he discovers to his horror that he cannot do it. He cannot do it. No matter how hard he tries. Oh, well, I'm not going to get excited about that. I've given you my first sign. The second one, I'm ordained a priest in 47. By this time, I think things are fixed. I've really crossed that invisible line. I developed these terrible personality clashes with the boss. I'm sure alcohol was in the picture. He doesn't face me down with it. He gives me my first geographical cure removal. You know what that is. You foul up your Columbus nest so bad you move to Phoenix City. But in short order, your Phoenix City nest is as foul as your Columbus nest because you brought yourself. You know that. It doesn't work. I didn't know anything about it. I just knew that the boss and I weren't getting along. We weren't even talking. We were communicating by letter, although we lived on the same hall. Does that ring a bell with some of you married people? Yeah. Tell your father so-and-so. Tell your mother such-and-such. And I got this letter and said to go to Barberville, Kentucky. And I said, in God's holy name, where is Barberville, Kentucky? And one wag of a monk said, you go to hell, turn left, and walk 3 miles. He was wrong. It's only two. It's where Kentucky, Tennessee, and Virginia come together, the Cumberland Gap area. And, oh, it was a disaster in 1952. It was a disaster. It was flood country in those years. Oh, poverty stricken. Lord have mercy. The first morning I got up there, the priest I was replacing said, after we'd said Mass, you take your meals over at Aunt Sally Coon's house, about a half a block over there. It belongs to you. And Uncle Albert is a retired miner. He's a Catholic, and he minds the church and the buildings while you are riding the circuits. Aunt Sally belongs to the Lottie Moon Circle, and whenever you're in town, she feeds you. So we go over for breakfast. The miner's cabin, hot September, I'm telling you, conversation is difficult. Uncle Albert, a gentleman in his 60s, is sitting there. I'm there. Here's Timothy. Uncle Albert's son is a state trooper in his 30s. All he had on was a pair of shorts. His two sons, 19, 17, that's all they got on. We're trying to make conversation. Aunt Sally's not a bit happy with the new priest. She's got the old one broken in. And sitting in front of me is a water tumbler beaded, and I pick it up and took two great big swallows. Well, you've seen the atomic bomb blasts. I couldn't see. I couldn't breathe. The hair stood straight up on the back of my head. There was this roaring of winds. I'm not lying to you. I'm convinced at that moment, if I had not been an alcoholic, I would have screamed bloody murder. But I don't. I just hang on tight till the tremors pass. Now, I mean, that's a real sign of alcoholism. You don't, you know, just hang on. And when I can see again and hear, Uncle Albert's got one, Timothy's got one, the trooper's got one, the kids don't have it. Well, when that breakfast was over, Timothy and I were stepping high over the weeds going back to the church. And I said to him, and I can remember this just as well that morning, I said, Timothy, in the Lord's holy name, what was in that water glass? He said, moonshine, 120 proof. I said, for breakfast? He says, anytime you can get it. Needless to say, Timothy followed me in this program about a year after I got here. Can you imagine that? And that was my introduction to white lightning. I never knew what that was, you know. And what a place to send a budding alcoholic. And I bloomed. I was there 4 or 5 years. I said, I don't get in any trouble. But that's not true, because serious alcoholic drinking takes time. And while I certainly did not get into any trouble with the law, for example, I did not do the job that I could have been doing if I wasn't drinking. I'm recalled to the college as dean. By this time, I got to have it. I don't have to drink it every day, but I got to have it in the closet where I can shake it, look at the frog eyes, read the labels, you know. What do you got to have it all stacked up there for? Well, in case I want to celebrate Hungarian Freedom Fighters Day, maybe snake bite, you know. And the pattern is the same. Once I start, I don't stop until there's nothing left. And these personality clashes build up again. And I'm sure by this time, the old man realizes alcohol's in the picture. But he won't face me with it. If he had, I'd have been on him like a bull on a bulldog. I'd have said, what are you talking about? I'm teaching 5 classes. I'm running this school. If I am drinking too much, I'm not hurting anybody except myself, which was a lie. Because that's the insidiousness of this disease. It not only affects the person himself, not only destroys his total personality, but it affects at least the 4 other people who are closest to him. His wife, his kids. It is a family illness. This is what makes it so insidious. And I get another geographical cure removal, this time to the Delta of the Mississippi. If you all think that's in southwest Louisiana, you are mistaken. It begins in the lobby of the Peabody Hotel in Memphis, Tennessee. And it goes downriver, 40 miles on the Mississippi side, 20 miles on the Arkansas side, and you come to Yazoo City. And if y'all never been in that part of the South, then you don't know what the South is all about. I got news for you. Those people do not know the Civil War was lost. They don't even know it was fought and couldn't care less. These were the long, hot, dry summers of the 60s. The dry, that was the wettest place I ever came to in my life. You will not understand how much trouble I had getting whiskey, and I'm not going to tell you about it. But when I came to Mississippi, I could pick up the telephone and say, Mamie, and she'd say, I'll be right there, Father. And Father Malachy tells me when I tell you that, that you must realize Mamie was the bootlegger. There were so many empty bottles in my closet. Every time I opened the closet, it was full of empty bottles. And that should have told me something. A normal drinker does not save empty whiskey bottles. He throws them away. But I had to save them. For what? I don't know. But anyhow, Mamie would come, take the dead soldiers out, give them decent Christian burial, put in new recruits, and send you a bill at the end of the month. Had it made in the shade. Except just like the big book says, I'm coming apart at the seams. The alcoholic comes apart. We come apart spiritually first. And then mentally and emotionally and finally physically, we actually come apart. We get so bad we can't walk. We crawl. That's physical. But I was coming apart. I was coming apart spiritually. I was supposed to be a priest, filling a pulpit honorably, trying to tell people how to run their lives. I couldn't stand myself. I'd look in the mirror and say, what is going on in your life? This terror, this bewilderment, this frustration. What is the matter with you? Stop it. I never in my life deliberately set out to get drunk. Every time I took a drink in those last years, I would say, it's going to be different this time. And it always was. It was worse. It was worse. It never got any better. I was coming upon emotionally. There comes a time, the big book says, when the alcoholic can no longer tell the difference between truth and falsity. Did you hear that? He can't tell the difference between what's true and what's a lie. And I was at that point. Oh, it was, and people were beginning to talk ugly about me. You can't hide it. You think you hide it. They know. Everybody knows. His wife knows he's an alcoholic. His boss knows he's an alcoholic. His children know he's an alcoholic. His dog knows he's an alcoholic. But he doesn't know it. Or at least he won't admit it. Oh, Lord, that wasn't the end for me, but some horrible things happened in Mississippi. They don't seem so horrible, I guess, today, but Lord have mercy. For example, where did you put the automobile? It's not your car. It belongs to the church. We would like to have the automobile. Where did you put the car? It cost $10,000. It's where? I don't know where the car is. Is it in Memphis? I don't know where the car is. And, of course, the horrible thing is that the car comes back 2 days later, brought by the next-door priests 20 miles away, who said, Father, you were too drunk to drive the car home after 40 hours, and you don't even remember it. And you don't even remember it. Well, that wasn't the end. We had a new boss at Coleman, a Yankee from Minnesota, didn't have a bit of sense. Came down here to save us from our sins. I love him today more than any man in the whole wide world because he did save my life. But I had been nominated president of the college, and the old man came over to interview me. I didn't know it. And when he left, he said he was perfectly well satisfied, and I got the job. When I was offered the job as president of the college, I was well into alcoholism. If you want to see the towering ego, anybody with any saneness offered that job, as I was, would have said, no, I cannot accept the responsibility for that job. It's too much. What does the towering ego of the alcoholic say? Certainly I'll take that job. You don't think they'd be offering it to a drunk? That'll show these people in this parish whether or not I'm a drunk. And they gave me a glorious send-off from Mississippi. I know today they were saying, thank God he's gone. But again, because of this blessed program, I've been able to make amends in Mississippi, and I can go back and hold up my head, and for that I'm grateful. I came back to the college, and I was president for about 3 years. And everything that hadn't already happened to me that happens to drunks happened. I've heard alcoholics say they've been in jail in every state in the Union. I've only been in one, and I never want to go again. I still remember very vividly waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning and saying, it's a funny bed I'm on. There's no mattress. It's all springs. There's no pillow. And when I can get my eyes open, there's bars at the window. And I thought, oh, Lord, you played hell this time. And I really resented the living daylights out of the people who built that jail, because when I got to the window in the cold, clear light of dawn and looked out, trying to figure out where I was, the way they had built that jail on an alley, I could not tell whether I was in New Orleans, Mobile, Pensacola, Montgomery, Nashville, Memphis, or Rome, Italy. No way. And I don't know, I don't generally tell this, but I'll tell it to you all tonight. If you know anything about the South, especially the small southern towns, there's always somebody in that little town who is Mr. or Mrs. Catholic Church. And whenever anything happens to the Catholic Church, that person gets called up and asked, what do we do about it? Well, in this little town in which I was incarcerated, the man in charge of the Catholic Church was Mr. Frank. And Mr. Frank got called up that night to say there was a priest in jail for drunk and disorderly, plus driving and other things. And what did Mr. Frank want to do about him? And Mr. Frank says, who is it? And he told him it was Hillary Draper, according to his driver's license. He said, well, leave him there. I'll get him in the morning. Well, When the morning came and they took me down to the sergeant's desk, and Mr. Frank was there to fish me out of the drunk tank, I tell you, I would rather have seen the Pope. Because guess who Mr. Frank was? Mr. Frank was the chairman of the board of trustees of the Hotshot College of which I was president. Was that a coincidence, do you think, Jim? Oh, I would rather have seen the Pope than to have seen that man. I tell you the truth. I thought I'd die when I saw him. But I conned him. He was just as good as he could be. Oh, Father Hillary, this is just terrible. We've got to do something about this. We've got to speak to the abbot. We've got to do... I said, oh, Frank, I just had too much cheese at the country club. And I conned the man. They should have blown the whistle on me right then, but I conned him. And it wasn't going to happen again. And it was a full year later before the end came for me. It was a December evening when the president of the college was to make a report on all the State of the Union message in front of all the important people of the college, the 50 monks, the lay board of governors, the teachers, the lay professors, the Student Government Association, the alumni. Don't exaggerate, 200 people for supper. And I'm speaking that report. And I made that report. Only the last thing is that day, the last thing I remember, it was 4:30 in the afternoon, I was taking one more drink to steady my nerves. And I went into a blackout, and I do not remember a thing, and still don't, about that day until the next morning at 6:30. And when I tell you that, I can begin to shake and sweat, because I can have some idea what it must have been like for those wonderful people to sit there and watch and listen to the obviously drunken Catholic priest, president of that college. That was my bottom. I didn't know it, but that was it, because they rang the bell on me. A few days later, I was still throwing dust up in the air, and I went in to see the chancellor, and he said, sit down, I want to say something to you. We've had a special meeting of the board of trustees. The only thing on the agenda is your resignation, and it is right now, signed here. And he read me the riot act in 5 or 6 gorgeous technicolor scenes. He told me what a disgrace I was to my own good name, how I had done my best to drag the name of the priesthood through the mire of drunkenness. It was just horrible. He doesn't know anything about alcoholism. He doesn't even know the name. I don't either. It's characteristic. He's telling me what it looks like from the outside. And what he says is, you cannot stay here. We've had enough of you. We will not put up with this behavior any longer. I will help you get a job anywhere in the country. You're a good teacher, but you cannot stay here. We don't want you. What I wish you'd do is go somewhere and get some help with your drinking problem. He doesn't even know the word alcoholism. I said, yes. I don't know whether I was scared. I think I was so scared I couldn't see straight. I think I was a coward of the first order. I couldn't conceive of myself going and finding a job somewhere else in the country trying to teach. I think that if I had not caught the hand of AA, because that's what it was that day, I would have been dead or insane by this time. I couldn't have stood the burden of guilt. And I said, yes, I would go anywhere and do anything I could. The old man had heard of a place named Hazelden up in Minnesota that had a reputation for doing good for people who were bad to drink. And I got sent up there to Hazelden. January the 14th, 1968 is my dry date. I didn't even know the word alcoholism. I didn't know what they did for you. I didn't know whether they stuffed something up in you, whether they cut something out of you, whether they twisted your head around, whether they blew through your ears. I didn't know what they did. Nothing. And I get dumped in a alcoholic rehabilitation center. Lord have mercy on my poor soul. Cold Minnesota. 60 degrees below with a wind chill factor. Oh, God knows. No one of those people drank. I nearly froze to death, I'm telling you. First morning I was there. That's the truth. They took me to see the counselor. And the counselor, then I'm just going to quote, the counselor says to me, now, Father Hillary, it's the last time we will call you Father because you ain't nothing but a goddamn drunk. You know, I was going to write to the abbot and say, you have sent me up here not only with profaners, but blasphemers. He said, you have no right to wear that Roman collar and that black dickie. You are not in good standing in the priesthood. Take them off. You got no right to be called father. Do you see the towering ego? Do you see it after everything that's going through? Sitting up there, butterwood melting him out. And they wouldn't call me father anymore. They would not. And the second thing he says is, don't plan for 3 weeks for this program. At that time, they had a 3 weeks program. I said, of course not. I reckon I'll get it in two. And I'm telling you the truth. And the man looked at me and says, oh, no, no. He says, we find for doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, salesmen, undertakers, pharmacists, college professors, and ministers, it takes 3 and 4 times as long to get this simple program. I'm quoting, and I said, why? He said, because y'all keep up such a dreadful front, it takes a long time to find out where the real Hillary lives. And that started it. I did not go to Hazelden to learn how to stay sober. I went to Hazelden against my will. I went to Hazelden to learn how to drink like I used to drink without getting in trouble. And the first thing they did after they got me in there was to sell me the big book and tell me to read it. And I opened it up to see if it had the approval of a Catholic bishop. And it doesn't. And I said, it's most likely printed in Nashville and it's foot wash and Baptist literature and I'll be damned if they're going to brainwash me. How do you like that for intelligence? And I would not read the big book. No. How much sense that made. They sold me the little 24-hour-a-day book at the same time. You remember that? You know that one? And that doesn't have any approval of a Catholic bishop. But I loved it. I read it every day. I wouldn't touch that thing. No. No. You're not going to get me. I'm not going to do it. We had to go to 3 meetings a day where they explained the 12 steps. After 5 weeks had elapsed, it became apparent to my cunning alcoholic brain that if I did not take, work, or do steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in this program, I was going to be in Hazelden until Gabriel blew his damn horn. And I decided I did not want to stay that long. And therefore, I stayed up one night and read the first 164 pages of the big book. I was so thrilled I couldn't see straight. After breakfast, I shot down to the counselor's office. I said, let me in. I have got step 1. My life is unmanageable. I'm powerless over alcohol. He says, you ain't got nothing. Get back. I said, I have got step 1. I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. He says, you are full of resentments. I said, I don't resent anybody. Of course, he was right. I resented God. I resented the Pope. I resented the Bishop. I resented the Abbot. I resented all the monks of St. Bud and all the professors of that college. I was just absolutely loaded with resentment and didn't see it and didn't know it and didn't know it. Eventually, little by little, I did get through the first and the second step. The second step was a joy to me. I had no trouble with that. I have to say that I did not surrender in those 3 weeks. I didn't get that. I think they realized, I don't believe that I got step 1, way down deep, where it's operated, for about 2 years. I don't think I got step 1 until I got to the master teachers, Juby and Tom Pettis at Coleman. I really don't. That's just the way I see it. But I guess I got enough of step 1 that they let me go on to 2, and 2 wasn't hard for me. What I had been doing was certainly insane. And when I learned that I could be restored to sanity, I was real happy. 3 was a positive joy. God had not walked away from me. I had walked away from God. I didn't realize that. It was a great reunion. It was homecoming. I was thrilled to death. 4, well, that was a mess. I made a mistake on that, too. They told me I had taken an immoral inventory. I should take a moral inventory. You might know I'd do it wrong, but they finally got me through that. I got through step 5, admitted to God, myself, another human being, the exact nature. That wasn't hard for me. I've been told you when you do wrong, you tell God you're sorry. And you tell yourself you're sorry. And you tell the priest. You tell him in the confessional, anonymously, in the dark, with the grill and the curtain. But AA says you do it eyeball to eyeball. And that do make a difference. Oh, Lord. I got through that step 5. I'll never forget that. Now, pay attention. I've just finished step 5. And the man says to me, now, if you believe you're an alcoholic, when you go back to Coleman, you're going to tell people you're an alcoholic. I said, of course not. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. I said, we don't run around with a big sign out on the south, watch out for me, I got tuberculosis. It's nobody's business. No, I'm not going to. I said, furthermore, you know I can't go back to Coleman. He says, why can't you go back to Coleman? I said, you know why I can't go back to Coleman? He said, well, you running around with women. I've just made a 5th step. I said, no. He said, did you embezzle the college's money? I said, no. Notice the realism of this program. If I had been running around with women, maybe the best place to send me back was not Coleman. And if I had embezzled the college's money, maybe I couldn't go back to Coleman. So he says, you lost the job as president of the college. You were thrown out of the priesthood because of the disease of alcoholism. When are you going to quit running? The bank president would probably have to go back, not as president of the bank, but pick up the pieces. I said, all right, I'll go back to Coleman. Now you convinced the board of trustees to let me come back to Coleman. Because, you see, I'm not the first priest in Alabama who ever had a problem with drinking. But I'm the first priest, thank God, who ever caught this blessed program of recovery. In the years that went before me, if we had a priest who had a problem with drinking, if somehow or another we could get him dry, we never let him return to the scene of the crime. Oh, no. We sent him to Louisiana or New Mexico or Nevada or Arizona, California, Honolulu. Go west, young man, go west. You start a new life. But here is the AA program telling me you go back to Coleman. And I went back to Coleman. I told you my dry date. I actually got back to Coleman about September the 1st. And that was because I had to spend some time in a halfway house. Some of you have been in halfway houses. That might encourage you, too. But when I got back in September, you'd think, I wish I could tell you it was glory, hallelujah, I went up the steps and no more trouble. I couldn't find you. You were so anonymous in Coleman, it was marvelous. You weren't in the phone book. We didn't have enough money in those years. You did advertise in the weekly newspaper, but I never saw the advertisement. Father Luke, not an alcoholic, a dear friend of mine, kept saying to me, aren't you supposed to be going to some kind of meetings or something? I said, yeah, but they don't have them in Coleman. He says, well, surely they have them in Decatur. You can go up there. I said, that's too far. I don't need it anyway. I read the big book, and I share my experience, strength, and hope with people who do them some good. You want to vomit now? You know, isn't that horrible? After all the money they've spent on me, what have I learned? Nothing. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. I did continue to read the big book, in the 24-hour day book. I think that's probably the only thing that saved. But I think I was getting crazier and crazier. It wouldn't have been but a short time that I'd have been back in the bottle, drunk again. But that December, Father Luke came back again. He said, for your information, AA is alive and well in Coleman. Call this telephone number. You know, I can't find it. He's got it. Every day he'd say to me, did you call? I said, yes, but they don't answer. Finally, he realized that if you want the right answer from a drunk, you got to ask the right question. He says, when did you call? I said, midnight. I'm not proud of that, but that's true. He said, ring him up now. I rang him up, and I got Juby. I'll never forget that telephone call. I mean it. Juby says he can't remember it. I do. I said, Mr. G, this is Father Hillary out of the college. I'm an alcoholic, and I need to go to an AA meeting. And there was this long silence on the phone. And the first thing that Juby ever said to me in that voice of his was, "Father, are you drunk now?" Notice the realism. That was the point. I said, "No." He said, "Well, that's fine. Don't take a drink today. It just so happens we have a meeting tonight. It was Tuesday night. 8 o'clock. I'll be along at 7:30 to pick you up." Notice he doesn't tell me where it is. He doesn't tell me to get there. He says, "I'll pick you up at 7:30. And I said, "Fine, Mr. G, but don't come to the front door of the college. I'll meet you down on the road to the cemetery under the high pine trees in the dark of the moon in front of the grotto." Every one of those there, except one of them, can show you that road to the cemetery, the high pine trees, the dark of the moon, where Juby came to get me that night. You know, it's the one he didn't say, "Hey, Father, when you want what we got, and I'm willing to go to every lake to get it, call me back." But he doesn't do that. He picks me up on the road to the cemetery in the dark of the moon. He takes me to my first meeting in Coleman. We go up the steps over the pool room where we still meet.
Oh,
I wish I could tell you it was glory hallelujah. Jim Hawkins is laughing already. Oh, Lord have mercy. I got up those steps in a little bitty room about as big as that table over there. A naked light bulb hanging down out of the ceiling. The plaster's coming off the ceiling. The wallpaper's rolling off. There's a hole in the floor where they sweep the day down on the man below. There's an old sofa with the springs coming out. There's about 10 people there, and they all look like Church of Christ and Foot Washing Baptists to me. And I thought, "Oh, my Lord, I'm in the wrong place for sure." Now, please don't be offended. That's the way it was. It's not that way anymore. We don't care what you go religious. It doesn't make any difference. If you're an alcoholic, you're my brother and my sister, and anything I can do to help you, that's fine. That's fine. But that's the way it was. And I'm standing outside, there's a glass in the door, and I'm looking in there, I think, "Dear God, if I can get out of this, I'll never come back again. I can't spend my life in this room. I could just, it's impossible." And Juby's disappeared. There are times when a good sponsor knows when to just get out of the way. And I wasn't going to walk 2 miles back to the coffin. While I was sitting there in that frame of mind, here comes the lady. She was dressed up as fine as any woman in this assembly this evening. She looked like $1 million. And I had known her as a splendid Catholic matron from Decatur. I had worked with her on church affairs. I did not know she was a drunk. I didn't know she was an AA. She walked up to me, and she said, "Hello, Father Hillary. We're so glad you're here. If you need what we've got, you're at the right place. Come on in. You're going to be all right." And she put her arm through mine, and she mesmerized me right through the door of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was the beginning. That was the beginning of life. Of life everlasting. That was the beginning. And when I tell you that, I almost shudder to think what would have happened in my pride, in my arrogance, in my stupidity, if that woman hadn't been there that night. And it was only after I was in the program 2 years or more I found out that that was all a put-up job and she was a shill. That after I called Juby, he called Decatur. He said, "Rosemary, come down here to the meeting in Coleman tonight." She says, "I can't. I'm chairing my own meeting." He says, "I don't care what you're doing. You get down here tonight. I got a Catholic priest coming in here. I know a damn thing about Catholics, much less priests. You're a Catholic, and you get down here and help me with him." And when the poor, stupid, drunken Catholic priest monk is trying to get through the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, says, "Rosemary, I'm telling you." Rosemary is still in the program. She's physically not well, but she's still in the program. She's still going to meetings Monday and Sunday nights. And I'll tell you, I'll walk a long way for Rosemary. I really will. That was the beginning. It has never, for me, done anything else but get better and better and better. I've made all the mistakes you can possibly make in this glorious program except take a drink. I've never taken another drink. I've never popped a pill, a mood changer. But every other mistake, you know, I remember asking him one time after I'd been in, I said, now I've been in this program 3 years and now I'm sober. Well, I wasn't sober, I may have been dry. But what I want to know is if I don't manage my own life, who's going to manage it? That's a good question. That'll get him for sure. Again, this terrible silence. And finally, Jimmy says, well, Father, you remember step 3 said made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. And step 11 said sought through prayer and meditation. I said, shut up. Don't tell anybody I asked that question. Here I am, an eminent divine, and I got to come to the drunks to learn theology. And I wasn't putting on. At one time, I knew the answer to that, that God is the man who's got to run my life. But here, I've forgotten it. And I have to come to the drunks. Well, it's always time for me to quit. Everything good that has happened to me has come through Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you one little story and then I'll shut up. Tom Pettis used to insist that I tell this. I used to prefer not to tell it. But he says it's part of your story, tell it. I told you I came into this program in 1967. In 1972, the boss resigned and the monks get together, they lock themselves up and start praying to the Holy Ghost to find, elect a successor, a head honcho. The juniors, the rookies don't get to vote, just the 33rd degree members get to vote, and therefore all the young people and the lay people are extremely interested in who is the new abbot. And in August of 1972, when they ring all the bells and everybody comes running, who is the abbot? The word goes out in that year, in August that day, that the seventh abbot of St. Bernard is Father Hilary. And the young monks are running all the way through. The young monks are running through the monastery halls, shouting all the way with AA. And that says something very special to me about the monks of St. Bernard. It really does. And that's what these gold chains and this big fat ring are all like. It's unbelievable. But Tom Pettis used to say, the thing behind that, Father Hilary, is that you need to tell that because it can say to AA people, you get into AA and you can go as far as you want to go. It is a long way from the drunk tank to the bishop's throne. And most people would say, you can't get there from here. But practicing the principles of this beloved and blessed program in all of our affairs, one day at a time, there's no ways you can't get. No way. Well, my time's up, but let me end up with this. I'm a preacher. St. Paul once said, we ought to live soberly and justly in this world. And ladies and gentlemen, I surely was not living. I was existing. And I wasn't living soberly, I was drunk most of the time. And I wasn't living justly. Man, I'd steal anything I get my hands on. And I sure wasn't in this world. I was anywhere else but this world. And what I'm like today, I'm trying to live. Oh, Lord, and what a delight that is. To live soberly. To know everything that happened. And justly. In this world, which is the only place you can live. If I had anything to say to St. Paul, I would say, St. Paul, you forgot something. You should have said we ought to live soberly and justly in this world, one day at a time. Thank you for listening to me.